Have you noticed anything about your neighborhood church? Maybe it's boarded up, converted to some other use, or just abandoned. I'm Mateo Schimpf, host of The Final Service. It's a new podcast series that answers a really big question in four parts. What does a community lose when a church closes its doors for good? And how will the ones that survive manage to keep them open? The Final Service drops April 10th, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Another prisoner swap today between the U.S. and Russia. It's the fifth such exchange in the last couple years.
So this has been an area where U.S.-Russian diplomatic efforts have led to actual results.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. More about the diplomacy between Washington and Moscow. Also, how a church in Panama is helping people who were recently deported from the United States.
I would say we are doing the Good Samaritan work.
We've got an update about the earthquake in Myanmar. And then, after a traumatic brain injury, how spending time with nature can help you heal.
We know from many pieces of research that even just having plants in your office enhances well-being.
All those stories and more just ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. After spending more than a year in a Russian prison cell, Ksenia Karelina, a U.S. citizen, was released in a prisoner swap today.
This is the second prisoner exchange between Moscow and Washington in less than 2 months. It comes as U.S. and Russian officials are meeting for talks today in Turkey. For more on all this, we're joined by The World's Daniel Offman. Just give us a bit of context here, Daniel. How did this prisoner swap actually go down?
The exchange happened earlier this morning in the United Arab Emirates on the tarmac of the Abu Dhabi airport. The Russian State Security Agency, they put out a video showing the moment of the swap. It kind of looks like a scene from a spy movie. You could see the prisoners walk past each other as they're escorted to the other side. According to reporting from the Wall Street Journal, CIA Director John Ratcliffe was at the airport during the exchange. And they also reported that Ratcliffe was the chief negotiator on the U.S. side. So that tells us that there's been some ongoing communication between the two countries, between the two intelligence agencies. And U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio posted on X earlier today that Karelina is, quote, on a plane back home to the United States.
So there have been several prisoner swaps lately, Daniel, haven't there?
Yeah, that's right. Overall, since 2022, the U.S. and Russia have conducted five prisoner swaps. So this has been an area where U.S.-Russian diplomatic efforts have led to actual results.
Who exactly is Ksenia Karelina, and why was she arrested in Russia?
So Karelina is a dual U.S.-Russian citizen. She lived in the L.A. area where she worked at a spa. She was also a former ballet dancer. She was in Russia last January visiting her grandparents in Yekaterinburg, which is a city about 900 miles east of Moscow, and that's where she was arrested. In August last year, she was sentenced to a 12-year prison term on charges of treason. So treason, Marco, that sounds very serious, but really all Karelina did was donate about $50 to Ukrainian charity. Late last year, Karelina was interviewed on Russian state TV inside her prison cell. Take a listen. So she says here that the reason she donated money was, quote, simple humanitarian reasons. It's about people, that the people there are just like people here. So referring to people in Ukraine and Russia. So that tells you something about the wartime atmosphere in Russia, where giving charity to Ukraine can land you in jail. Of course, Russia also has a history of detaining U.S. citizens to be used as bargaining chips in these kinds of swaps.
Well, as you said, Daniel, this was a swap, a prisoner swap. Who did the U.S. release in exchange for Karelina?
So Karelina was swapped for a man named Artur Petrov, a Russian-German dual citizen. Petrov was detained in Cyprus in 2023, and he was extradited to the U.S. He was arrested for leading a scheme to export U.S. microelectronics to Russia that would be used for manufacturing weapons for the Russian military. So like in previous U.S.-Russia swaps, there's this kind of contrast between the alleged crimes committed by those being exchanged. So Karelina donated to a Ukrainian charity while Petrov was charged with smuggling parts for Russia's war effort. We saw a really similar thing in the Brittany Griner exchange in 2022, where she was swapped for Victor Boot, an international arms smuggler and a wanted criminal across the globe.
So I mentioned earlier that there are talks going on now in Turkey between U.S. and Russian officials. Are these two events related, these talks and the prisoner exchange?
I believe so. And I think the connective tissue is the trajectory of the U.S.-Russia relationship. So the Trump administration, it's been looking for a fresh start with Russia. And prisoner exchanges, they're a sign of goodwill. And today, during talks in Turkey, the two sides are hoping to build on that goodwill. And their focus will be bringing back diplomatic staff to their respective embassies in Washington and Moscow. Now, I think Russia and the U.S. also have more ambitious goals. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin, they've talked about potential economic cooperation. Now, the elephant in the room in all of this, Marco, it's Ukraine. And there have been some signs of the Trump administration growing impatient with Putin when it comes to negotiations about a ceasefire. But it looks like the Trump administration is eager to kind of separate these two issues. So a ceasefire with Ukraine is not a precondition for restoring closer ties between the U.S. and Russia.
The World's Daniel Hoffman is in Washington. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thanks, Marco.
In February, the U.S. deported almost 300 asylum seekers to Panama. Most of the deportees come from Africa, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. They were fleeing civil wars and religious persecution, and their deportation has been widely criticized by human rights groups. Some are still stuck in Panama and are not sure where they can go next. Manuel Rueda recently caught up with them to hear their stories.
In the outskirts of Panama City, an old school has been turned into a shelter for the asylum seekers who were deported from the U.S. 2 months ago. There are 59 people staying here in the gym, where they sleep on mattresses, including Mohammed, a carpenter from Iran. For security reasons, he asks us not to use his last name.
I have family, and I am very worried about my future, my life, because I am very young people.
Mohammed says that 5 years ago he began to attend an underground church and eventually converted to Christianity. That's illegal in Iran and is punishable with prison time.
In our country, whose people changing his religion, the government killed us. A big problem for me and my wife is religion.
Mohammed left Iran in December after he had a dispute with a customer that owed him $30,000.
He's starting problem with me, and because he know I am Christian, he told my information to government.
Mohammed arrived at the U.S. border in January and turned himself into the border patrol to seek asylum. But he says he was not given a chance to make his case, which should include an interview with a specialized officer.
They don't let us to say anything. Just what is my name? They didn't let us.
Mohammed says he was placed in the detention center for 10 days and was then put on a flight to Panama, where he's still not certain if he can apply for asylum.
They didn't have any information about refugee asylum. When I am asking of these people, they told me, I don't know what happened for you. I don't know.
Most of the people in this shelter say their lives are in danger if they return to their home countries.
In Afghanistan, we have the most extremist group and religious group in Afghanistan.
Ayatollah Umag was a data scientist for Afghanistan's election commission. He fled the country when the Taliban overthrew the nation's government.
People who work in the ex-government, they are under persecution still. When someone like me go back in Afghanistan, it's very dangerous. You cannot imagine.
Omeg and the rest of the migrants were deported by the U.S. under Article 212F, a section of the Immigration and Nationality Act that was written in 1952.
Which basically says that the president can, by proclamation, deny entry to categories of people.
Bill Frelich directs the Refugees Division at Human Rights Watch. He says there are contradictions in U.S. law, because more recent additions to the Immigration and Nationality Act say that U.S. officials have to give asylum seekers a chance to have their cases heard.
At the end of the day, someone could have a hearing, they could make their claim, they could be denied, and they could be deported. But that's not what happened in this case. People never were able to make claims at all.
Frelick says that thousands of others have been denied due process when they arrive at the U.S. border, including many Latin American migrants.
Well, it's a deflection of responsibility. And so the United States, under the Trump administration, is trying to figure out ways to shortcut due process and to shortcut the costs associated with detaining people for the duration of their claims.
According to Frelick, Panama has been improvising with the migrants who were deported by the United States because it's not used to receiving large numbers of asylum seekers. The group deported to Panama was first taken to a hotel where they were not allowed to leave their rooms. Omeg, the former Afghan government worker, says some were pressured into accepting flights to their home countries.
The second day, they came and they told us, you have two options in Panama. You can go back to your country as a volunteer. If you refuse that, Panama government send you back to your country by force. Not just for me, to all of us.
About two-thirds of the migrants accepted the offer. The rest were taken to a remote camp on the edge of the Darien jungle, where they had little access to the outside world.
We didn't have the phone. We couldn't go outside. If someone wanted to go to a bathroom, when immigration security was following him or her.
On March 7th, officials decided to free the migrants and drop them off at a bus station in Panama City. The group was told they had 3 months to stay in Panama while they found some other nation that would accept them. But finding a new country for the migrants will be complicated, Frelick says.
You're not talking about human rights obligations in this case. You're talking about generosity. You're talking about, you know, essentially political decisions. You're talking about solidarity with Panama.
Fe y Alegría, a Catholic group that runs education projects, has been hosting the migrants since they were dropped off in Panama City. The organization owns a school where the migrants are now staying. There's free internet access, and in the afternoon, volunteers come by to give them Spanish classes.
Elefante.
Elefante.
Ele, ele.
Elefante.
Muy bien.
One man here tells me this is like the Tower of Babel. The migrants staying here are from many places, including Russia, Eritrea, Cameroon, China, and Sri Lanka. Father Marco Gomez of Fe y Alegría says that by helping this group, he's trying to stay true to Catholic doctrine.
This was someone else's responsibility, you know. But we're human beings, they are human beings, we all have the same dignity. So as Christians, as human beings, you know, it's our duty to take care of our brothers and sisters.
Some of the people staying here have said they might apply for asylum in Panama, but others are still hoping that the United Nations can refer them to wealthier nations like Canada, the UK, or Australia that have better programs for asylum seekers. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Panama City.
If you've been or known a kid in the last 30 years or so, odds are you're familiar with the fantastical world of Pokemon. That's the roar of the famous dragon-like character Charizard. Then, of course, there's the real star of the animated Japanese franchise.
Pikachu!
Pikachu! Pokemon trading cards have been popular since the mid-90s, and now a community center in Japan is bringing that idea into the real world.
Community leaders in the town of Kawara in the prefecture of Fukuoka created a set of trading cards depicting local heroes instead of fictional ones. Each card has a picture of one of the town's elders featuring details like their nickname and special skills.
For example, a man who used to make noodles for a living is called the Soba Master. A retired electrician is the Plasma Conductor.
Local reports say kids in the area are loving the new trading cards. The community center came up with the idea to build stronger bonds across generations.
One of the designers told the Japan Times she hopes that children will now aspire to be just like the heroic elders on the cards. And when you've got inspirational role models, you gotta catch them all.
I wanna be the very best.
Real.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Courts in Istanbul today released 127 defendants on bail. Most of them are university students. They were arrested on March 24th for protesting the arrest of Istanbul's mayor. He's a leading opposition figure in Turkey. Outside the jail where the students were held, parents have been gathering in a picnic area to call for their release. From Istanbul, The World's Duri Baskaran reports.
Around a picnic table full of snacks, the parents share tea and savory börek, a pastry stuffed with cheese, and they wait for visiting hours to begin so they can see their kids. They were exercising their right to protest, says Zeynep Tatlı. They did nothing wrong. Tatlı is here for her son, Berkant Tatlı, a 24-year-old student at Istanbul Technical University, studying city planning. 3 weeks ago, he walked out of class and joined peaceful protests in support of the imprisoned Istanbul mayor and presidential candidate Ekrem İmamoğlu. Berkant was arrested by police a few days later, after they came to his house in a dawn raid. But his mother says the students are in good spirits. They know they're innocent. They know that it's a process and that it will pass, Tatlı says. They're trying to stay positive. The students are being held in a prison known as Silivri, the largest high-security jail in Europe. Each cell houses 4 to 5 young people. Lately, the parents have been coordinating an effort to bring them textbooks so they can study for their midterms. I don't even know how they can study under these conditions, Tatlı says. Her son, Berkant, was supposed to sit for an entrance exam for a graduate program on Sunday. Attorneys for the students say some were injured during their arrest. Others were subject to strip searches in custody, a claim denied by Turkey's justice ministry. But conditions seem to have improved in recent days, with parents and supporters permitted to bring them clothes and other supplies.
I know that all Turkey think that the kids are unguilty and should be free.
Bilge Tiryaki is a volunteer for a nationwide network set up to support the parents of the students. She says that Turkey's economic crisis, widely seen as a result of the country's democratic backsliding, is pushing young people to take to the streets.
These kids are so brave that they want their future to be free.
The students are accused of violating a temporary ban on demonstrations and gatherings that was put in place following the arrest of Istanbul's popular mayor on March 19th. Some are also accused of insulting the Turkish president, which is considered a crime in Turkey. It's cold today, and the rain's falling. So Ali Çulcu pours everyone a cup of strong black tea from a thermos. He made some of the pastries himself. Çulcu isn't a parent of a detained student, but he feels this moment personally. During a military coup in 1980, Çulcu protested and was detained for 2 months. I was a student too, he says. There will always be someone in power who considers someone as a traitor or an enemy. Turkish President Erdogan has defended the arrest of protesters. In a speech Tuesday, he called the demonstrations and boycotts against his government an all-out attack, targeting the peace of the nation and the Turkish economy, under the pretext of protest. Classes continue on campuses across the country, but student protesters are continuing the work that their friends left behind, holding walkouts, speeches like this one, and posting their classmates' photos in lecture halls. In a protest attended by thousands last night, the crowd called out the names of arrested students. They included Berkant, whose mother waits for him outside the prison. He's here, they chant. But when more than 100 young people were released today, Berkant's name was not on the list. For The World, I'm Duri Baskaran, Istanbul.
It must have been a heartbreaking sight. More than 50 dead hippos have been spotted floating on their sides and backs in a major river in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The hippos, along with local Cape Buffalo, apparently died in an anthrax outbreak. Rangers at the Virunga National Park in the DRC were struggling to get the heavy carcasses out of the Ishasha River. The hippos were then to be buried in caustic soda in an effort to stem any outbreak. German biologist Fabian Leendertz knows a lot about the spread of zoonotic diseases, including anthrax. He's the founding director of the Helmholtz Institute for One Health in Greifswald, Germany. Fabian, is this sort of outbreak unusual?
Anthrax is actually part of nature, and in intact ecosystems, you will have anthrax outbreaks from time to time simply to regulate the animal populations.
And remind us the anthrax bacteria, where it occurs in nature and how an animal like a hippo would come into contact with it.
Yeah, the anthrax bacteria, interesting, they're bacilli. They're in two forms. One form is when it's in your body and it's multiplying. But when you die and the bacilli come in contact with air and some other factors, they can form spores. And these spores are very stable and can stay in the soil and in the environment for many, many years. And so this is where grazers, for example, get reinfected from the ground when it's really dry or something changed in the environment, and then they get that infection from the environment. So classically, it's a point source infection.
And that source would be what? Contaminated soil, water, plants?
In most cases, an area where another animal had died, and then the body was opened in a natural system by a scavenger, for example, and then there are enough spores to maintain in the ground. And then you have a very dry season. The animals are biting the grass very low, and they're inhaling and eating much of the soil. Then you have a risk of getting reinfected.
Is the size of this outbreak unusual? At least 50 dead hippos, we're hearing?
The interesting thing here is it's very unlikely that those 50 dead hippos and the buffalo, they all got it from the environment, actually, because then something dramatic must have changed somewhere. What people often forget for hippos is they're actually not that herbivore as they look like. They love to scavenge, and we have published already papers on the hippos scavenging on other hippos. And then when you eat another animal which died from anthrax, that's obviously a very bad idea, and this can explain this outbreak-like pattern which we see.
Is there danger that it might be spread, anthrax might be spread to local livestock or even humans?
Well, everything getting into contact and basically eating on the carcasses and around is at risk. And that can be a livestock by chance, or that can also be humans who may, in their tradition, not have a taboo to eat actually animals found dead. So that's obviously a very dangerous thing to do. It's not spreading through the air, and even in water, it's often very quickly, very well diluted. There are actually no spores formed in water.
There is a team on site trying to get these dozens of hippos out of the water, the river that they are in, to bury them. What are they doing to prevent the next anthrax outbreak? Do you know?
My recommendation has always been and would be to try actually to leave the hippos in the water, because if these vegetative bacilli come out of the body when it's open somewhere, then if they go in water, they will not form spores, and these bacilli will die relatively quickly in the water. So the safer place would be to keep them in the water, but try to have them not accessible for the other hippos, because otherwise they could get infected. The more wise thing is to leave them in the water if the water is deep enough and not have them accessible.
Fabian Leendertz is a biologist and the founding director of the Helmholtz Institute for One Health in Greifswald, Germany.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It was almost 2 weeks ago that a devastating earthquake hit Myanmar. At least 3,600 people were killed, but that is just an estimate. The real figure is probably thousands more. Rescue operations have mostly wrapped up by now. Civilians, though, are still retrieving bodies from the rubble of collapsed buildings, usually with no help from the authorities. The need for aid in Myanmar is overwhelming right now. But as we hear from The World's Patrick Nguyen, very little is getting through because the military government is blocking it.
A man with a buzzsaw grinds through mangled rebar in the ruins of a building. Few emergency crews and almost no media have made it this far, to the town of Sagaing, near the earthquake's epicenter. But this one did. A volunteer team whose name I won't disclose for security reasons. They sent me previously unseen cell phone videos of their work. With a jackhammer, the team punches through a concrete floor in a destroyed room with no roof. Still standing is a door to the room. There's a sign on it that reads Grade 5. This was a school. They're recovering the bodies of children. The video is pretty hard to watch.
Picture the day-to-day desperation of the population.
Marzuki Darusman is a former United Nations official who was appointed to investigate abuses by the country's military. He says the army's response to the quake has been dismal. The military government is looking after their own, while civilians fend for themselves.
They are in dire conditions in terms of day-to-day survival.
On top of this quake, Myanmar is engulfed in revolution, a nationwide armed uprising against its power-grabbing military junta. Basics like medicine and electricity were in short supply even before the quake. Now there's a scramble just to find a little rice and water.
I would say personally that it's approaching Gaza-like condition.
Darusman and other ex-UN officials belong to a group called the Special Advisory Council for Myanmar. They help the international community connect with the country's citizens outside military channels. They point to a big problem with the way aid is coming into Myanmar.
All international aid will have to go through the junta to be delivered to the people who need them.
The military government has shown gratitude to the 18 countries who've pitched in to help, saying, "Everyone sympathizes. Everyone understands." But the junta is also clear. Only they decide where foreign aid goes. According to the UN, the junta restricts aid to areas deemed rebellious. The problem is, Sagaing, near the epicenter where the suffering is greatest, it's on their bad list. This region of rolling plains and ancient temples seethes with anti-military fervor. So only a trickle of help gets through.
Normally, you would have the government of a country that had experienced a humanitarian crisis putting their people first.
Claire Gibbons is with Partners Relief and Development, a charity doing relief work in Myanmar for decades. They have teams of Myanmar citizens trying to bring food and water to villages, but they're hitting checkpoint after checkpoint after checkpoint.
What's been consistent is that the response of the Myanmar military is to directly impede and limit humanitarian assistance to their own people.
The military and most of the resistance fighters have agreed to pause fighting, briefly. But according to the UN, military officers scour ruined neighborhoods, looking for young men healthy enough to clear rubble. It is exhausting work, breaking down cement floors to reach bodies underneath. But the volunteer crew that did make it to Sagaing and shared footage with me, they're not quitting. In one crushed building, under a pile of debris, they saw a woman's hand. It was moving. They said, "Hey, can you wave?" "How," she says, Burmese for yes. The woman was trapped in a tiny pocket of space under a concrete slab next to several dead people. She was rescued a few days after the quake, but the chances of finding anyone alive now are virtually zero. Those who survived barely have time to grieve. Claire Gibbons says people are just trying to survive the elements, the heat and lashing rains.
Most of these communities were already deeply impoverished. Those that have lost their homes are generally sleeping in temples or alongside neighbors or friends.
Many others are sleeping on the street, some under mosquito nets, donated by China, the biggest aid donor. As for the United States, it did send a three-person aid team, but then fired them shortly after they arrived to the quake zone. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
The place is Washington, D.C., the year 2054.
Set up a perimeter and tell them we're en route. I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks.
Give the man his hat.
The future can be seen.
Tom Cruise stars in the 2002 sci-fi action film Minority Report, where he plays a police chief whose pre-crime department can predict and stop crimes before they even take place. Well, Britain's Ministry of Justice is doing research along these same lines. That's according to a new report by a UK-based watchdog group called Statewatch. It says the ministry created something called a homicide prevention project using AI and government crime databases to assess who might be most likely to commit murders in the future. Chris Jones is the director of Statewatch and spoke with me earlier today from London.
What we found is a research project, a plan by the Ministry of Justice, Greater Manchester Police, who are the very large police force in the UK, and a couple of other authorities to extract large amounts of data from the Greater Manchester Police computer system and compare that with Ministry of Justice data and try and use algorithms to predict who is at risk of committing violent offences, in particular murder. So their project was called the Homicide Prediction Project, and that's precisely what it intended to do.
What kind of personal information do those databases contain about people, and which of those factors are supposed to determine who is more likely to commit murder?
Yeah, I mean, the data sharing agreement that was released to us following a Freedom of Information request has the precise list of what they're interested in. It's sort of basic biographical information like age, name, date of birth, nationality. Then there's other things such as, has this person been convicted? Have they been convicted of a violent offence? Have they received a warning? Have they received a caution? Are they a suspect? Are they a witness? And then more sensitive kinds of data. So things like ethnicity, religious beliefs, what would be considered sort of special categories of protected data under UK data protection law.
The UK government says it is just looking at data of people who've been convicted of a crime in the past. So criminal records that they already have in their databases. Your organization claims otherwise. What evidence do you have?
We have the documents that they gave us, which say that the Ministry of Justice will receive from Greater Manchester Police data not just on people who have been convicted, but on suspects, witnesses and victims of crime as well. So it's clearly far wider than what they say.
And do you know that the data from those who have not been convicted of crimes, like victims, is included in their databases that are targeted at looking at future risk of homicide? Or do they just have that data and they're not putting it in those databases?
That's a good question. I mean, as part of a data sharing agreement between the police and the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of Justice was due to receive this data. What they've gone on to do with it is it's a black box. We don't know precisely. But they certainly received it in the first place, so it's been used by them for some reason. If they weren't going to use it, why would they receive it?
Mm. The Ministry of Justice said that this is for research purposes only, this project, and won't cause any direct operational changes. Given that, what are your concerns about civil liberties here?
Firstly, I would say that these people don't conduct research unless they plan to at least have an idea they may want to operationalize it in the future. So, you know, you don't go researching murder prediction unless you think, oh, maybe we'd like to try and do some murder prediction in the future. That being said, I mean, I suppose on a basic level, there's a privacy question. Just because you have been a victim of crime or witnessed a crime or even been convicted of a crime, why should your data be shared for a data science experiment that you've not been informed of or consented to? Then there's the broader issues that arise with all sorts of systems of this type, which is that data held by the police and the criminal justice authorities reflects the biases of those authorities. So there's been numerous official reviews and studies in this country that have concluded that the police and the criminal justice system are institutionally racist. They've been found to be institutionally misogynist. Their systems and their data are riddled with bias and discrimination. You put that into an algorithm, any sort of automated system, it will reproduce that bias and discrimination. So that's really the broader issue here, is bias in, bias out, effectively.
If there were a world, and I acknowledge that we are not in that world, but if there were a world where the data that they were using was not biased or was no more biased than the investigators whose own brains would be doing this work, if not for AI, do you think that this could be a valid tool to use, given that there is data on what might make someone more likely to commit a violent crime that is accepted?
I'm very doubtful about that. And I think that sort of comes across another of the broader problems with tools like this. I think as a society, we put a lot of faith in technology to solve deep-rooted social problems. And those kind of problems should be solved through social means and through political means. And some sort of computer-based techno solution is not going to solve the problem.
And Chris, this project is not being operationalized yet. Do you know anything about when or how or if it might be?
We don't know. So they changed the name from Homicide Prediction Project to something far more anodyne. I think it's now called Sharing Data to Improve Risk Assessment. Presumably they realized that Homicide Prediction Project doesn't have a great ring to it. But yeah, where things stand right now, we don't know. Our last Freedom of Information request was filed at the end of last year. The project was due to end at the end of 2024, but has been continued. But where things stand right now, we're not sure. We'd have to do some more research to find out.
Chris Jones is the director at the British advocacy group State Watch. He spoke with us from London.
When artists from different cultures collaborate, they can find all kinds of unexpected connections on the path of creativity. Case in point, two musicians recently got together, one steeped in the ancient music of Kuwait, the other an Afro-Cuban pianist. We'll get back to the Afro-Cuban part of the story in a moment, but let's start in Kuwait, where the music of Pearl Divers captured the imagination of Ghazi Faisal Al-Mulefi. He's an ethnomusicologist and jazz guitarist, leads the ensemble Boom Diwan. His grandfather had been a pearl diver on the Persian Gulf. Ghazi recently told me about the tradition.
Pearl diving would not have existed without pearl diving music. And so pearl diving is basically what it sounds like, diving for pearls in the Gulf and trading them in Zanzibar and India. And so basically on the ship, if the pearl divers were not sleeping or praying or eating, there was music for every occasion. The music was spiritual and that also unified their movements, their bodies.
Are you able to demonstrate for us right now, like the rhythms of a pearl diving song?
Let's see if we can do something here. So, one.
In 1955, the music and its complex rhythmic patterns stopped. Pearls were no longer of financial interest in Kuwait. Instead, Ghazi says, the Kuwaiti government saw its future was with oil.
Pearl diving was outlawed in Kuwait in 1955 because the country was moving towards a petroleum economy. And the funny story is a lot of people who collected oysters at the time would sell them in the markets as kind of like scratch tickets. To see if you did find a pearl in the bag of oysters that you bought. And since gambling is frowned upon in Islam, they decided that they would just outlaw the whole thing and let Kuwait move on to its next economic chapter, as it were.
Well, now in 2025, Ghazi is creating a new chapter in the story of pearl diving music. He's doing it with the help of Grammy-winning band leader Arturo O'Farrell. O'Farrell told us he'd been investigating the links between Arabic music and Afro-Cuban jazz with a little help from a friend who runs the NYU performance program in Abu Dhabi.
I reached out to my friend Bill Bragan and we met with him and said, man, I really want to do something that explores the trade routes, the spice routes, and the way that this music got to us. And so he graciously invited me to Kuwait to meet Ghazi and Boom Diwan. And it was transformative. I have to tell you, besides just being someone that I love so much, I feel like I have found a long-lost brother.
That search for the connections between Arabic and Afro-Cuban landed you later in Abu Dhabi. What was the moment when you both decided that two heads going in the same direction were better than two different directions? Ghazi?
I mean, it really happened quite organically. When we were first jamming in Kuwait, we had an incredible aha moment that there was something both spectacular and familiar and new all the same happening. So when we showed up to Abu Dhabi at the Art Center at NYU Abu Dhabi and rehearsed with Arturo's orchestra, the percussionists were jamming the exact same rhythm, yet both kind of claiming it as their own and calling it different things. And it was really surprisingly natural.
People would rather think that, you know, music is this thing that is germane to a culture or to a nation or to a people. But I really believe that all of us, and especially in culture, are interconnected in ways we can't even begin to understand.
The universal language, I guess, isn't it?
It's more than just that it's universal language. Very specific aesthetics that permeate our music are draw us together. Very specific performance practices, very specific rhythms.
Ghazi, talk a little bit more about what Arturo is referring to there.
So one of his musicians, Abdurrahman Amr, a.k.a. Rocky, said, what we're in fact doing is not discovering connections, but uncovering bridges that already connect us. And so these musics that we share are really born of voluntary and involuntary migrations. And really, it's really the slave trade that connects both of Afro-Cuba and the Afro-Gulf. And so, you know, I really thought this was a far-fetched idea, to be honest with you, when we first started this journey. But we were really uncovering connections that were forgotten, but that are really rooted and really exist. And we're really recognizing each other in this music. So basically, this music contains histories and memories of connectivities that we have forgotten about, but that we are uncovering in the words of Abdurrahman Amr, in his words. I really thought that was such a wonderful statement. We're not discovering anything. We're uncovering everything.
Ghazi Faisal Al-Mulefi and Arturo O'Farrell, the new album from their ensemble Boom Diwan is called Live in Khalij.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Sarah Alley was riding a bike near her home in Sydney, Australia, when she was hit by a car going the wrong way.
The next moment I remember is I'm on a stretcher and I'm being wheeled into the hospital and I'm lying in an emergency waiting room in a lot of pain and I really don't know what's going on.
That was in August of 2015. Months later, she was still suffering from the concussion.
I don't think they understood how badly I was injured. They tried different medications, so they tried to see if that would help with the headaches. I was, if anything, getting worse.
Alali's experience with a traumatic brain injury and her background as a journalist led her to look into whether nature might help her heal. It is something our partners at Deutsche Welle dug into as part of the podcast Living Planet. Here's DW's Neil King.
The mental health benefits of time spent in the forest are well documented, but a rapidly increasing body of research suggests it's not only woodlands that can enhance the way people feel. A 2021 US study found evidence for associations between exposure to nature and improved cognitive function, brain activity, blood pressure, physical activity and sleep. And last year, researchers in Australia found that people who feel connected to nature and regularly visit public green space have lower stress, anxiety, and depression scores than people who don't. So what exactly is going on there?
There is a really consistent body of research showing that people who are struggling with emotional difficulties gain quite a bit from nature.
Holly Ann Passmore is Associate Professor at the Department of Psychology at Canada's Concordia University of Edmonton. Her research includes how nature can impact human well-being.
There's two types of attention. So there's hard attention or direct attention. So that's you're reading a book, you're driving. Nature, though, captures our attention in the way that's generally called soft fascination. And from a neuroimaging framework, we can see that people are using fewer resources in their brain. And of course, when you do that, what are you doing? You're giving your brain a break. You're actually allowing your brain to recover. And that leads to a sense of emotional restoration as well.
But what about physical brain health? Can contact with nature aid recovery from the kind of mild traumatic brain injury Sarah Alley suffered after being knocked off her bike?
I had a real light bulb moment. It was October and the accident happened in August. And I was invited to go on a bushwalk with some friends and I took my kids. And it was the first day since the accident that I hadn't had a headache. And it was extraordinary. And I was, there's something about being in the bush, in the forest, in nature that is really working and is really good for me. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew that something had changed. And then as soon as we were in the car home and I started looking at Google Maps, a direct from my friend, the headache started coming back. So I said to my specialist, so this thing happened. I went for this bushwalk, this hike, and my headaches went away and I had this great day. And He wasn't particularly surprised. He kind of explained it as you'd have something stimulating in the nature and the bush, but that it's not going to be aggravating.
Which chimes with the idea of soft fascination. After this positive experience, she now turns towards nature more decisively.
I then started going for quite deliberate, slow walks around my neighbourhood along a local river, just looking at gardens, and I'd really notice how I'd come back and the depression and the anxiety had lifted. It was very noticeable. The headaches would go away. I'd feel clearer.
Though at the time there isn't anything like the volume of research on the topic that there is in the post-pandemic world, Sarah comes across an article and a book connecting time in nature with improved concentration and overall mental health. What she can't find, though, is anything linking time outdoors with mild traumatic brain injury. So she decides to embark on her own research project, which becomes a podcast she calls Brain on Nature.
No one's telling me to do this, but it's obviously working. No one seems to have done any research, so I'll do my own research.
As part of that research, she interviews her neurologist and asks whether, based on her positive experience of spending time in nature, he would suggest other patients do the same. His answer is that while there is evidence of how being in nature benefits general brain function, there is none relating to brain injury, and that he can only prescribe things with a scientific base.
And he was very pragmatic. He said, I'm a neurologist and I can't tell them to just go and sit on a rock and look at the ocean.
Over the years, Sarah has received messages from lots of people with brain injuries, some recounting a similar experience and others saying how listening to her story prompted them to spend more time in the natural world with positive outcomes. By the time Sarah does eventually return to work, she's been off for 8 months. And although her life soon fills back up with commitments, she continues to make time and space for walking or just being in nature.
It is very good, I think, to actually just go back to the same places, because then it's less about, like, which way am I going, how much further, and you're actually just really can sort of sink in quite deeply, but also that's actually connecting you more with the natural world.
And that connection can have a deep reach. There have been various studies over the past years seeking to assess how much time we should be spending in nature. The results differ, but as far as Holly Ann Passmore sees it, the more important metric is attention. She asks people in her research groups to notice how the nature in their environment makes them feel. And her results consistently reveal the potential benefits from using whatever time is available to observe what is already there.
Paying attention to the nature in your everyday life and noticing how it made you feel had these incredibly large boost on different aspects of well-being. We know from many pieces of research that even just having plants in your office enhances well-being.
Holly Ann says we tend to think of nature as being out there, somewhere beyond the city, in mountains or by the ocean. But we don't need to look that far away to reap the benefits.
Deutsche Welle's Neil King reporting there. The story is an excerpt from the podcast Living Planet from our partners at DW.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. As always, we'll see you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.